Osher. Seeds of Revolution, my most loved gospel on Jesus. Commentaries on the fifth gospel of St. Thomas. Discourse number 15. Given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India.
Bhagwan, Jesus said, I am the light that is above them all. I am the all. And the all came from me, and the all attained to me. Cleave a piece of wood, I am there. Lift up the stone, and you will find me there.
Jesus was strange in one of the oldest secret schools. The school was called Essenes. The teaching of the Essenes is pure Vedanta. That's why Christians don't have a regard. What happened to Jesus before his 30th year? They have a little regard of his childhood, and they have a regard after his 30th year, up to the 33rd when he was crucified. Few things they know. But a phenomenon like Jesus is not an accident. It is a long preparation. It cannot happen just any moment. Jesus was being prepared for these 30 years continuously. He was first sent to Egypt, and then he came to India. In Egypt, one of the oldest traditions of secret matters he learned. Then in India, he came to know about the teachings of Buddha, Vedas, Upanishads. And he passed through a long preparation. Those days are not known because Jesus worked in these schools as an unknown disciple. And Christians have knowingly dropped those records because they would not like that the Son of God was also a disciple to somebody else. They will not like the very idea that he was prepared, taught, trained. That looks humiliating. They think the Son of God comes absolutely ready. Nobody comes absolutely ready. If somebody is absolutely ready, he cannot come. In this world, you always enter as imperfect. Perfection simply disappears from this world. Perfection is not of this world. Cannot be. It is against the very law. Once somebody is perfect, his whole life enters into a vertical dimension. This has to be understood. You progress on a horizontal plane from A to B, from B to C and D and up to Z. horizontal in a line from past to present, from present to future. This is the way of the imperfect soul. Just like water flowing in a river from the hills, plains to the sea in a line, vertical, always maintaining its own level. Perfection moves in vertical lines, not horizontal. From A, it doesn't go to B. From A, it goes higher than A. Then higher, more higher. On the line, those who live on the line, for them perfection simply disappears. It is not there. Because they can look in the future or in the past. They can look back. He is not there. They can look ahead. He is not there. They can look here. He is not there. Because a new line of vertical progression has started. He is going higher and higher and higher. He moves in eternity, not in time. Eternity is vertical. That's why it is eternal now. There is no future to it. If you move in a line, there is future. If you move from A to B, the B is in future. When B will become present, A has gone into past and C is in future. You are always between past and future. Your present moment is just a passing phase. The B is turning into C, the D is turning into everything moving into the past, and your present is just a line cut, just a small fragment. By the time you become aware, it has moved into past. A soul which becomes perfect moves in a different dimension altogether, from A to A1 to A2 to A3, and this is eternity. It lives in the eternal now. That's why it disappears from this world. To enter into this world, you have to be imperfect. It is said in old scriptures that whenever a man comes near perfection, many times it happened that he will leave something imperfect to come back again and to help people. Otherwise, there is no way to come back. It is said of Ramakrishna that he was addicted to food, just obsessed. The whole day as if he was thinking of food. He will be talking to his disciples, and just whenever he will get a chance, he will go into the kitchen to ask his wife, What new thing are you preparing today? Even the wife many times felt very embarrassed, and she will say, Paramhansdev, this doesn't suit you. And he will laugh, and one day the wife persisted that even disciples laugh about it, and they say, What type of liberated man is Paramhans? He is so addicted with food. Whenever Sarada, his wife, will bring the food, he will stand immediately to look in the thali what she has brought. He will forget everything about Vedanta, the Brahma. And sometimes it was very embarrassing, but because people were there and they never could conceive. So one day the wife persisted, why you do this? There must be some reason. Ramakrishna said, the day I don't do, then you can count 3 days more I will be alive here. The day I stop, that will be the signal that only 3 days more I will be here. The wife laughed, the disciples laughed. They said, this is no explanation. They couldn't follow what he means. But it happened the same way. One day wife came in. He was lying on his bed, resting. He turned his side. Otherwise he would have jumped out of the bed to see. And the wife remembered that he had said that only 3 days more he will live. The day he shows his indifference towards food, she couldn't hold the thali. The thali went down. She started crying. Ramakrishna says, but you all wanted it to be so. Now don't get worried about it. 3 days more I am here. And the third day he died. Before dying he said that he was clinging to food just as a part of something imperfect in him so that he can be here and serve you. Many masters have done that. The moment they feel that something is going to become completely perfect in them, they will cling some imperfection just to be here. Otherwise this bank is not for them. If all the fetters are broken, then their boat sails towards the other bank. Then it cannot remain here. They will keep one fetter. They will keep some relationship. They will choose some weakness in them. And they will not allow it to disappear. The circle will not be complete. A gap remains. Through that gap, they can remain here. That's why Hindus, Buddhists, Jains, who know very deeply, because they have known many masters, know well that perfection is not of this world. The moment the circle is complete, it disappears from your eyes. You cannot see. It is not then on the line of your vision. It has gone above you. There you cannot penetrate. But to say that Jesus was perfect when he was born, to emphasize this fact, Christians have dropped all the records. But Jesus was as much a seeker as you. He was as much a mustard seed as you. He became a tree, and a great tree. Millions of birds of heaven sheltered in him. But he was also a mustard seed. Remember that. Even a Mahavir, a Buddha, a Krishna, they all are born imperfect, because birth belongs to imperfection. There is no birth for the perfect. You are perfect, then there is no transmigration. Because of this training, Jesus, moving into Egypt and India, learning from Egyptian secret societies, then Buddhist schools, then Hindu Vedanta, made him a stranger to the Jews. Why he became so much a stranger to the Jews? Why Jews could not absorb him? Why they could not forgive him? They have not forgiven yet. What was the reason? He was bringing something alive, something foreign. He introduced some secret which didn't belong to the race. That's why crucifixion happened. Hindus tolerated Buddha because whatsoever he was saying, it was not a lie. He may contradict Hinduism, but he can contradict only the superficial Hinduism. Even in his contradiction, he proves the deeper Hinduism right. He may say that the establishment has gone wrong. He may say that the organization has gone wrong. He may say that the whole followers have gone wrong, but he cannot say that Hindus are basically wrong. Whatsoever he says, Hindus can understand it. It is not foreign. It is not a lie. Whatsoever Mahavir says, Hindus simply tolerated it. He may be a revolutionary, but he remains a Hindu. Buddha may be a revolutionary, but he remains a Hindu. He may be a rebel son, but he belongs to Hindus. Nothing to worry much. But Jesus is not only revolutionary, he doesn't belong. From where it happened that he doesn't belong to Jews? How it happened? Christians have no answer to it. From where he brought this aligned teaching? From Egypt and from India. India has been the source of all religions. Even those religions which are against Hinduism, India has been the basic source. Why it happened that India has been the basic source of all religions? India is the oldest civilization. And the whole mind of India has been working and working and working in the dimension of religion. It has come upon all the secrets of religion. No secret is unknown. In fact, for thousands of years, you cannot teach any secret to India about religion because they know all. They have discovered all. They have completed the whole journey in a way. So all that is beautiful in religion, wherever, you can be certain somehow it comes from the source. Just like as the Greek mind is the source of science, the whole scientific development comes from the Greek mind, the logical mind, the Aristotelian mind. All mysticism comes from India. And only two types of mind exist in the world. One is Greek, another is Indian. If you are basically a Greek mind, it is impossible to understand India at all, because it looks absurd. Whatsoever they say looks unproved. Whatsoever statement they make, they look meaningless. Aristotle will be absolutely foreigner in India, because he believes in definitions, clear-cut demarcations, distinctions, and he believes in the law of contradiction, that two contradictory things cannot be together. A cannot be A and not A simultaneously. That is impossible. A man cannot be alive and dead simultaneously. That is impossible. Apparently he is right. Hindus believe in contradiction. They say man is alive and dead both simultaneously, because life and death are not two things, you cannot demarcate them. Greek mind is mathematical, Hindu mind is mystic. All mysticism comes from India, just as the sun rises in the east. All mysticism rises in the East, and India is the heart. This sutra, to be understood, you have to go to the Upanishads. The roots are there. You cannot find anything in the Old Testament or in other records of Jews from where this saying can come. That's why Jews could not believe Jesus, what he is saying. Jesus says again and again that I have come not to contradict the old scriptures but to fulfill them. But what scriptures? Which scriptures? He never says that. If he has come to fulfill the Old Testament, then his statement is wrong. Because he contradicts the old statement almost always. Because the Old Testament depends on revenge. The Father, the God, is very revengeful. Fear is the base of the Old Testament and its religion. You should be God-fearing. And Jesus says God is love. You cannot fear love. And if there is love, there cannot be any fear. And if you have fear, how can you love? Fear is poison to love. Fear is death to love. How can you love a person if you are afraid? Fear can create hate, but fear cannot create love. So a religious man in the Old Testament is God-fearing, and in the New Testament a religious man is God-loving. And love and fear are totally different dimensions. Jesus has said, it is said that if somebody harms your one eye, you pull out his both eyes. But I tell you, if somebody hits you on one cheek, you give him your other cheek also. This is absolutely non-Jewish. It was not there in the tradition. So when Jesus says, I have come to fulfill the scriptures, which scriptures he means? If he had been in India and he had said that I have come to fulfill the scriptures, we would have understood. Because Upanishads are the scriptures he has come to fulfill. Dhammapada, Buddha's sayings are the scriptures which he has come to fulfill. Because they depend on love, compassion. But Jewish scriptures are not at all concerned with compassion and love. They are concerned with fear, guilt. That's why whatsoever he says, Jews understood it well, that he has not come to fulfill our scriptures. You cannot find a saying like this in the Old Testament. I am the light that is above them all. I am the all, and the all came from me, and the all attained to me. Cleave a piece of wood, I am there. Lift up the stone and you will find me there. You can find thousands of sayings like this in the Upanishads, in Gita, in Buddha, but you cannot find a single parallel in the Old Testament. So which scriptures he has come to fulfill? He has come to fulfill some other scriptures, some other traditions. This saying is absolutely Vedanta. So try to understand first the standpoint of Vedanta, then you will be able to understand this saying. Jesus is born as a Jew, lived as a Jew, died as a Jew. But this is only as far as the body is concerned. Otherwise, Jesus is a pure Hindu. And you cannot find a purer Hindu than Jesus. Because the base of Upanishadic religion is his base. He created the whole structure on that base. So try to understand what that base is. Jews say God is the creator and this universe is the created. And the created can never become the creator. How a painting can become the painter? How a poem can become the poet? Impossible. And if the poem tries to become the poet, the poem has gone mad. And if the painting tries to prove and asserts and claims that I am the painter, then the painting has gone wrong. Man is the creature and God is the creator. And this distance can never be completely go. This space will remain. You can come closer and closer and closer to God, but you can never become God. This is the base of Jewish thought. And from Jews, Mohammedans learned this. Mohammedans are more Jewish than Jesus. As far as the thinking, the way of thought is concerned, Muhammad is nearer to Moses than Jesus. Muhammad has not learned much from Hindus. But Vedanta says the God is the creation. There is no distinction between the God and the creation. He has not created the universe like a poet creates a poem. The relationship is just like the dancer and the danced. They remain one. If the dancer stops, the dance disappears. And if the dance disappears, the person is no more a dancer. The universe is not separate. It is one. The universe was not created in time and finished. It is each moment created. It is being created each moment because it is God's own being. Just as you move, you sing, you love, God creates. Every moment He is creating. And the creation is never separate. It is His movement, His dance. That's why Upanishad can say, Aham Brahmasmi. Upanishad can say, the seers who have come to know this secret, they can say, I am God. And nobody thinks this is a blasphemy. This is the truth. Jews can never say, I am God. This is blasphemy. Nothing can be worse than this assertion. You trying to be God, a creature trying to be God, a slave trying to assert that he is the master, this is egoism. What is pure religion in Vedanta is egoism for Jews and Mohammedans. Vedanta says this is not ego. Because this feeling that I am God happens only when the I has disappeared completely. When you are no more there, when the house is vacant and the boat is empty, then suddenly you become aware that you are all. If you are there, how you can think that you are all? If you are there, then you have a boundary, a personality. then your assertion is false. When I disappears, when there is egolessness, only then you can feel you are all. Jesus' assertion comes from the Upanishads. The first thing to be remembered, the creation and the creator are not two, they are one. Second thing to remember, ordinary mathematics says that part is never equivalent to the whole. Part can never be the whole. In mechanism it is so. You take a part of your car, the part cannot be the car. It is so obvious. You cut your hand is not you. Part cannot be the whole. This is ordinary logic. And if the world is a mechanical thing, then it is true. But Vedanta says that existence is organic, not mechanical. With organic unity, a different type of mathematics becomes applicable. The part is the whole. This is the greatest absurdity. That's why they could say, I am God, because I am just a part. God is the all. How the part can be the whole? If there is a mechanical relationship between me and existence, then this is not possible. But if there is an organic unity, then this is possible. And there is organic unity. You exist not as a separate unit, complete into yourself. No. You exist not as an island. You exist as a wave of the ocean, an organic unity. You are one. The ocean goes on moving and waving in you. You cannot be without the ocean. And deeply if you understand, the ocean can also not be without you. You are totally joined together. You can say that in every wave there is ocean, and you can say ocean is nothing but the totality of all the waves. So wave is not separate. You cannot take a wave away from the ocean. You cannot bring it home to show to your children that I had gone to the ocean and I have brought a wave. You cannot bring the wave. You can bring the water, but that will not be a wave. That will not be alive. Look at the ocean. When the waves are there, they are alive because the ocean is their life. When they are jumping hundreds of feet, reaching to the sky, the ocean is reaching through them. You may not see the ocean, you may just see the wave, but you cannot separate the wave from the ocean. They are organically one. Vedanta says that the created is organically one with the creator. The world cannot exist without God. This can be understood by Jews and Mohammedans also, but Hindus say something else also, the second part. They say the God cannot exist without the world. That is blasphemy for Jews. What are you saying? That God cannot exist without the world? Yes, it cannot exist. It is impossible for him to exist. If he is a creator, if creativity is his quality, how can he exist without the universe? When there is nothing created, how can he be a creator? The world depends on him, he depends on the world. It is an interdependence. The world is not independent of him. He is also not independent of the world. There is a deep love relationship. They depend on each other. They fulfill each other. They are one. The fulfillment is so total that you cannot separate and divide them. So a seer, one who has come to know, can declare, "I am Brahmasmi, Anal Haq, I am God." And when he says this, he is simply saying that I and this existence are not two. He is simply saying that you will find me anywhere you go. Wherever you go, you will find me. The form may be different, but I will be there. This is what Jesus is saying. Cleave a piece of wood, I am there. How can Jesus be there if you cleave a piece of wood? You cannot find the form. You will not find the son of Maryam and Joseph there. You will not find this carpenter boy there. If you cleave wood, then what you will find? Being you will find. And he is saying that I am being. My form will change, but not I. Cleave a piece of wood, I am there. Lift up the stone and you will find me there. This is pure Vedanta, an organic unity. That's why only Hindus are in the world, who don't bother much about temples. They can make anywhere their temple. Just under a tree they will put a stone, any stone, not even carved, and they will paint it red, and God is there, and they can worship. Any tree is enough. Any river, any mountain, anything will do, because cleave a piece of wood and I am there. Lift up the stone and you will find me there. So why bother? Hindus are alone who dispose their gods. They make a god for 2-3 weeks, they worship. When the worship is over, they go to the ocean and dispose the god. You cannot think a Mohammedan disposing a god. You cannot think a Jew disposing a god. What are you saying? Disposing a god in the ocean? Are you a heretic? Have you gone mad? Only Hindus can do this, because they say the ocean is also God. And why carry a god too long? When the function is finished, dispose, because he is everywhere, all over, and we can make him again any moment. Any stone will do. Being, not the form of Jesus, you will find everywhere. And that beingness is the point to be understood. That beingness is God. When a tree flowers, it is God flowering. When a seed sprouts, it is God sprouting. When a river flows, it is God flowing. God is not a person. If God is a person, then there is a problem. And Jews had the idea that God is a person. God is a no person. He is pure being. He is existence itself. He exists in all. But you cannot find him anywhere in particular. He has no abode. You cannot go and knock. He has no address. You cannot write a letter to him. In a way, he is nowhere, because he is everywhere. You cannot pinpoint him. You cannot say, "Here is God," because that will be wrong. only something can be pinpointed which has a form, which has a distinction from other things. How can you pinpoint something which has no form, which is in all, is spread all over? But Jews had a conception of a very personalized God, and whenever there is personality, there is ego. So Jews' God is very egoistic, very, very egoistic. You disobey him and you will suffer for eternity in the hell. It is very serious. God becomes a dictatorial force, and the whole existence becomes a slavery. Then freedom is not for you. Freedom is God's nature, not yours. Slavery is going to be your discipline. Jesus is saying absolutely the contrary, that God is not a person. God is energy. The very life force, what Bergson has called the Elan Vital. It is existence as such. And wherever something exists, God exists, because nothing else can exist. This was the difficulty why he could not be understood and had to be crucified. Even if he was saying that I am the Son of God, it was possible for the Jews to forgive him. But basically he is asserting more. As his disciples became attuned to him, he went even further. In this sutra he says, I am the light that is above them all. He is not saying that he is the Son. Here he is saying that he is the Father. I am the light that is above them all. I am the all. Here he is saying, I am God, not the Son. And the all came from me. And the all attained to me. Cleave a piece of wood and I am there. Lift up the stone and you will find me there. In this sutra he asserts that I am God, not the Son of God. Even Son can be forgiven because the distinction remains. Father remains the source. Son is just a product. They may be in deep intimacy, but Son remains Son, Father remains Father. The distinction can be maintained. And the Son has to obey the Father. A relationship exists. It is not the relationship of a slave to the master, but a son to the father. More intimate, but it's still a relationship. They remain two. This sutra is not recorded in the Bible, cannot be recorded. He must have asserted it only to his disciples, because those who have been in intimacy with him, now they will be able to understand. This cannot be told in a marketplace. There he was saying, I am the Son of God. With his disciples he says, I am God, not the Son. I am the source of all. I am the Alpha and the Omega. Everything comes from me and everything attains to me. This is pure Vedanta. You cannot find anywhere else assertions like this. You will have to go to Gita and Upanishad. This is what Krishna says to Arjuna. But I am all, the source of all. Everything comes from me and everything dissolves in me. Throw your ego and come to my feet. This is as if Krishna is speaking. And there is a tradition, a beautiful tradition, I don't know how much it can be proved, but it is beautiful and needs no proof. There is a tradition that Christ is just a form of the word Krishna. It is possible. In Bengali, Krishna is still called Christo. Because Krishna is not the name of the person. Krishna is his absolute achievement, just like Buddha. Buddha is not the name. The absolute achievement. When one becomes enlightened, the word Buddha means one who has awakened. What Krishna means? The word means one who has become the center of the world. Krishna means the magnetic center, one who attracts, who is now the center of the whole existence. Christ has the same meaning. Maryam has named her son as Jesus. Christ is added to Jesus when he became the center of the world. In this assertion he is saying that I am the center. The all, everything comes from me and everything goes back to me. You go away from me and then you have to attain to me. It is possible that Christ is just a form of Krishna. It is significant. Because Krishna's assertions in the Gita and Jesus' assertions like these are exactly the same. The third thing to be understood about Vedanta that Vedanta accepts you as you are, because rejection will mean rejecting God itself. Rejection means that something has to be done. As you are wrong. Something has to be cut. Something has to be thrown. As you are not accepted. You are not welcome. You will have to change yourself. Only then you are welcome. Vedanta says, as you are welcome. Nothing is to be done. The very concept of doing has been the cause of your misery. The very concept of doing that something has to be done has been the very cause of your misery. Because whatsoever you do will lead you into the world. That's why Hindus say it is because of karma. Karma means doing. You are in the world. Karma does not mean bad doings. Karma simply means doings, because you have been paying too much attention to do this or that, you are in the world. Don't pay much attention to the doing, pay much attention to the being. Don't think what is to be done, just think who you are. Vedanta is amoralistic. It doesn't bother about morality and immorality. It has no 10 commandments. It does not give you any orders. It does not talk in terms of art. It says, as you are welcome. As you are good, beautiful, true. The problem is not that others reject you, the problem is that you reject yourself. And if you reject yourself, you are in a vicious circle. Then you will try to improve. And nothing can be improved because you are God Himself. Then you will be in misery because it is impossible to improve you. As you are divine. How the divine can be improved? And if you try to improve the divine, then you will move from one life to another, improving, improving, and never any improvement happens. You remain the same. It is just like jogging on the same spot. But you think you are running fast, and because perspiring and breathing so hard and doing such great work, you think you are running fast, reaching somewhere, and you are standing on your spot, jogging. Your whole life is jogging. You are not going anywhere because there is nowhere to go. You are not improving because it is impossible to improve. The ultimate is within you, which cannot be improved. There is no further to it. There is no better to it. This is what Vedanta says. Vedanta says that you are divine. This has to be realized, not worked out. You have simply to look within and realize who you are. The problem is not that you are bad. The problem is that you don't look at yourself. The problem is of knowledge, not of doing. The problem is of a right perspective, where you can see yourself. It is just like as if a diamond is taught to become a valuable stone. And the diamond gets the idea and it starts to become a valuable stone. Just this idea will become the barrier. And all the efforts the diamond can do are going to be futile because it is already the most precious stone. When the diamond will come to understand the futility of effort and will drop all efforts and will become aware who I am, then the problem will be solved. I have heard once a man rushed into the office of a psychiatrist and said, "Doctor, now you have to help me. It has gone beyond my limits. My memory is lapsing. I cannot remember even what happened yesterday. I cannot even remember what I said this morning. Help me, I am going crazy." The psychiatrist asked, "When this problem started, when you became aware about this problem?" The man looked puzzled and said, "What problem?" Because he had forgotten. That is the problem. You have forgotten yourself. That's the problem. And whatsoever you do will create karma. And karma is a cycle, a wheel. One karma leads to another, then A to B, B to C, you move from one part of the wheel to another, and it is a wheel. It goes on moving. karma can never lead you to liberation. Because you are already liberated. This is the most difficult thing to follow, that you are already liberated. People come to me and I have to tell them to do this and that, because they will not understand that they are already liberated. I have to tell them to do this and that just in order to exhaust them. Just in order so one day they become so exhausted with the effort, they come to me and they say, I don't want to do anything. Then only I can say, there is no need to do anything. But you needed much. When you came in the beginning, you needed much to do. And if I say there is nothing to do, you will go and move to somebody else who can say that there is something to do. Nothing is to be done. Absolutely as you are already divine. This is Vedanta. It is not a morality. It is religion, pure. And that's why there are not many Vedantins in the world. Cannot be. That's why Vedanta cannot become a world religion like Christianity or Islam. Impossible. Because you need, you have a deep need to do something. And if somebody says nothing is to be done, you are already the case that you are Brahma, you are divine. You will not listen to him. He is talking nonsense because you don't accept yourself. You reject. You have to reach a goal. Why this thing has happened in the mind of man? It has happened because of the childhood, and everybody passes almost the same childhood. Only tribal things differ. Otherwise, the childhood has one basic element, and that element creates the whole problem. The element is that no child is accepted as he is. A child is born, you were a child, and immediately the society, parents, mother, father, brothers, people all around you start to change you, to make you more beautiful, to make you more moral, to make you more good. As you are wrong. Something has to be done, only then you can be accepted. And the child starts by and by to feel that he is not accepted. If he does a good thing, then he is accepted. If he does something wrong, then he is rejected. If he follows, obeys, he is accepted. If he disobeys, nobody loves him, he is hated. And everybody becomes angry. One thing he learns, that doing is the question, not being. Do the right thing, and everybody will love you. Do the wrong thing and everybody will reject you and hate you and be angry and be against you. You are not the point. Do something right and the world is welcoming. Do something wrong and every door is closed. And even if father and mother's door is closed, what to say about this strange world? Those who love, even if they can't see the being of the child learns one thing, that to exist in this world, this is a basic, that you should behave, you should always do the right thing, never do the wrong thing. This creates a deep rejection about himself, because those wrong things go on coming up. Just by saying that something is wrong, it is not dropped. It goes on coming. then the child starts feeling guilty about himself. He rejects himself. He says that I am no good. I am a bad child, a bad boy, a bad girl. And the problem is that things which we call wrong are natural. So the child cannot throw them, they have to persist. Every boy, every girl starts playing with the sex organs. It is enjoyable. It gives a soothing feeling. The whole body feels blissful. And the moment the child touches his sex organ, everybody stops immediately. Everybody feels embarrassed. The father, the mother, they will stop him. They may bind even his or her hands so he cannot touch. Now the child feels in a very deep riddle what to do. He likes the feeling that comes from the touch. He enjoys the feeling. He feels it is beautiful. But if he is to follow that feeling, then everybody rejects he is a bad child. And they punish him and they are powerful. So what to do? And such a wrong thing is happening to me, the child thinks that it may be that only I am doing this wrong thing. Nobody is doing that wrong thing. And he cannot know about others. So he feels guilty that the whole world is good, only I am guilty. This is a deep problem. The child doesn't feel like eating because he knows more about his hunger than you. But you follow a medical routine. Because the doctor says after every 3 hours, the child has to be fed. It is written in the books, and you have read the books, and you are an enlightened parent. So, after 3 hours, with the alarm, you have to feed him. Look at children when they are forcibly fed. They reject it. They are not opening their mouths. The milk is flowing down. They are rejecting everything. They will not even swallow because they know their hunger. They don't live by the routine, by the clock. They don't know what your medical science says. They are not hungry, that's all. And you are forcing food. And when they are hungry and they are crying, you will not give because this is not the right time. Who is to decide? The child or you? If you decide, then you will create in the child a guilt feeling because he will think something is wrong. When I should feel hungry, I don't feel. When I should not feel hungry, I feel. Saint Augustine has said that God, forgive me because whatsoever is good, I never do. And whatsoever is wrong, I always do. But this is every child's prayer. Then guilt is created. The child is not feeling like going to the toilet and you force. Toilet training is such a guilt creating thing. You cannot conceive what you are doing. If the child is not feeling like, how can he go? You try yourself. If you are not feeling, what you can do? And the child is not feeling. You force him, you persuade him, you coax him, you bribe him, you do every method that you can do. You are creating a guilt. Something is wrong. Something is bad. And the child feels guilty and he cannot do anything about it. He does not know how to, because body is not voluntary. It is a non-voluntary phenomenon. The child doesn't feel like going to sleep. He is feeling perfectly alive. And he wants to run around the house or in the garden. And you say, go to sleep. what you can do if you are not feeling sleepy. And somebody says, go to sleep, you can close the eyes. And when the father is gone and the mother is gone, the child simply left in an abyss. What to do? How to follow the order? How to be a good boy, a good girl? Sin is created. And by and by, the small child is poisoned. He becomes aware that I am not good. Everything is wrong. Whatsoever I do is wrong. If he plays, he is wrong, because he is creating noise. He is disturbing you. If he sits silently in a corner, something is wrong. Are you ill? He is always wrong. The only thing, because he is helpless, nothing else. And you are powerful. He is confused continuously. He cannot sort it out, what to do and what not to do. And by and by, he rejects all that is bad and he forces all that is not good. He becomes a mask. And deep down in the unconscious, all the wounds are carried the whole life. That's why, if I say, as you are God, you cannot believe, you are not even good. How can you be God? God means the ultimate good. You are not even ordinarily good. How can you be God? You will not listen to me. You will go to some teacher who will condemn you, who will say, you are guilty, you are a great sinner. Then you will be at ease. He is right. Because this is what you also feel. That's why people who can condemn, who can look at you as if you are worms, ugly, dirty, you worship those people. If you see around a saint, a so-called saint, great following, you always find this reason. Because he is going to condemn everybody. He will say, you are sinners. And if you don't listen to me, you are going to be thrown to the hell. He feels absolutely right, because this is your feeling. He agrees with you. So whenever he condemns, you feel good. What absurdity. What nonsense. And if somebody says, you are good and I accept you, whatsoever you are, as you are, divine has chosen this way to be. Divine has chosen in you this way to be. This is how divine exists in you. I accept it. I don't reject any part. I accept your sex, your anger. I accept your hatred, your jealousy. I accept you in your totality. Because through this acceptance, when you are total, the one will happen. And that one immediately transcends all jealousies, all angers, all sex, all greed. Nobody can transform greed. One has to become one. Then there is transformation. That's why Jesus could not be forgiven. Because Jews are the greatest guilt creators. The whole world has done that, but no comparison with Jews. The whole world exists according to Jews because Adam and Eve committed the original sin. You are born out of Adam and Eve and their sin. Man is born in sin. Sin remains to be the central concept. How can they accept that you are God? You can be close to God if you repent, if you change yourself, if you become good, then the God, the Father, will accept you. Otherwise, as you are, you cannot be accepted. You have to be thrown away and away and away from God. And what was the sin of Adam and Eve? Because they disobeyed. But why God will be so obsessed with obedience? Because every father is. And your God is nothing but a cosmic father. Why God should be so obsessed with obedience? could not he take a little joke? Could not he be a little playful with his children who were enjoying? Could not he take it a little less seriously? And what they had done, just eaten one apple from a tree which God has forbidden. The God seems to be very egoistic, because ego is always obsessed with obedience. Follow me, I am the rule. If you disobey, you hurt my ego. But God cannot have an ego. He cannot insist on obedience. This must be the priest, not God, who has created the holy story. And then you feel guilty. You are born in sin. You are a sinner. Already when you are born, from the very birth you are a sinner. All that is left to you is to polish you, cut you here and there, and make acceptable. Vedanta says, you are not a sinner. You may be ignorant, but you are not a sinner. This is a totally different attitude. And God is not against you. You may be against God. And He is not taking any revenge on you. If you are ignorant, you are creating your own troubles. This is a totally different attitude. If you are in ignorance, you create your own troubles. If you ask Hindus, they will say, you may have gone into trouble because you have eaten the fruit of the tree of ignorance, not of knowledge. Man can be ignorant. He is, because he is not aware of himself, who he is. And then everything goes wrong. But it is not a sin. So religion is gaining more light, more knowledge, more awareness, not more morality, not more virtue. Virtue will be a byproduct. When you are aware, virtue will happen. It will follow like a shadow. When you are unaware, sin will follow, because ignorance cannot do anything else. It can only commit mistakes. Sin is like a mistake. It is just like somebody adding 2 to 2 and concluding 5. But it is not a sin. If somebody thinks that 2 plus 2 make 5, will you think that he is now to be thrown into hell for eternity? It is a mistake, an error. But it is not a sin. He has to be taught. He has to be given a right perspective of things. He may not be knowing mathematics, that's all. Vedanta says, you are simply unaware, ignorant of yourself. If you become aware, you are God Himself. There is no God except you, other than you. But this is not an egoistic assertion, because this can happen only when the I, the center, has disappeared and you have become all. Jesus says, I am the light that is above them all. I am the all. And the all came from me. And the all attained to me. Cleave a piece of wood, I am there. Lift up the stone and you will find me there. This is one of the greatest poetic assertions. And I would like to say to you that a man like Jesus is more like a poet than a philosopher or theologian or a mathematician. He is more like a poet. And if you miss his poetry, you miss his message completely. If a poet says something, you can forgive him, because you say it is mere poetry. But if a saint asserts something, you take it very seriously, because much is at stake. Jesus is a poet, poet of the ultimate. And all those who have reached to the ultimate are poets. The language of mathematics is very narrow. It cannot say much. It is very exact. That's why it is very narrow. Poetry is inexact, vague. That's why much can be said through it. But with a poet, you have to remember this, that he is talking about mysteries. Hindus have never killed any enlightened person. Why it happened? Because they thought that whatsoever they are saying, whatsoever they assert, is a poetic way to say a thing. You need not analyze it, otherwise it will be stupid. For example, if you go to Jesus and say, okay, if you say you are the light that is above them all, if you say you are all, if you say that all came from me and the all attained to me, then show us, prove it. Tell the sun to go off. Or create another moon this night. Then we will believe. Then you are stupid. You have not followed, because it is a poetic assertion. It is not a scientific statement. Because of this, Christians have been continuously trying to prove that he did miracles. He created bread out of a stone. He revived a dead man. He did this and that. He opened the eyes of those who were blind. He touched the lepers and they were healed. Why so much insistence on miracles? Because we have never paid any attention to Buddha as a miracle maker. Nobody ever bothered whether this man can do any miracle or not. But why about Jesus so much insistence? If somebody proves that he has not done the miracles, then the whole point is lost. Then Christianity disappears. Christianity depends not on Jesus, but Jesus' miracles. If someday it is proved that he never raised a man from death, he never cured a blind man, he never healed a leper, then Christianity will immediately disappear. There will be no church, no pope, everything gone. Because they don't depend on Jesus directly. They depend on the miracles. Because miracles prove that he is the Son of God. No miracle can prove anything. Miracles really prove the ignorance of those who are impressed by miracles. Nothing else. And as far as I know, Jesus never did any sort of this thing. He was not so stupid to do miracles to convince you. Miracles happened around him. a far greater significance than you can think. Yes, blind people started seeing, but this is not concerned with the physical eye. It is concerned with a deeper spiritual blindness. Yes, dead people were revived, but this is not concerned with corpses, but you, who just think you are alive and you are not. He made many dead people alive. He brought them to life from their corpse-like existence. And this is a greater miracle, because the other miracle can be done by medical science any day, and the day is not far off. It has already been done. In Soviet Russia, in the Second World War, they revived 6 men from death. They succeeded. 2 or 3 of them are still alive. This will be done by medical science any day. There is nothing. And once medical science will be able to do it, what will you do with your Christ, the miracle maker? Then he may have been a very good doctor, a scientist, but not an enlightened man. Eyes can be cured, they will be cured. Body is not the point. Body should not be the concern really. Jesus did miracles, but those miracles are spiritual. They are concerned with the inner being of you. You are blind because you cannot see yourself. What type of eyes you have got? A person who cannot see himself, what type of eyes he has got? Jesus made you seeing. You looked into the inner world. He gave you eyes, right? But not these eyes which look into the world. This has to be understood. He never made any bread of any stone, because this is foolish. But followers look for miracles, because enlightenment they cannot see. Christhood they cannot see. A Krishna is invisible to them. They can only see a stone turning into a bread. They can only believe in this world. And if something is done in the matter, then it becomes a proof to them. That's why they follow magicians rather than enlightened persons. They follow people who can do tricks. And all tricks are useless. They prove nothing. They prove your ignorance, and they prove that the other man is cunning and exploiting you. Jesus was not cunning. You cannot find such an innocent man. He was not cunning. He cannot be a miracle maker. He is not a magician. And he is not interested to exploit your ignorance and think that if he had done really these things, that is, stones turned into breads, water turned into wine. I have heard about one woman who was carrying whiskey in a bag and was entering into another country. On the boundary she was stopped and asked what she is carrying. She said, holy water. But the man on the check post was suspicious, so he said, I would like to look, because these people who carry holy water are always suspicious. Water is enough, why holy? So he looked, it was whiskey. So he said, what? And the woman said, Lord, see the miracle again. Jesus turned water into whiskey. He revived dead persons. Lazarus came out of his grave. Eyes were given. People who could not walk, walked, could not see, could see again, could not have heard, started hearing. If really these miracles happened, then Jews themselves would have believed that this is the man of God. Because Jews are as materialist as anybody. If these things had really happened, then Jews must have become mad after this man. They are even more materialist than any other race. But they didn't pay any attention. It is impossible. It is impossible not to follow a man who is doing such things. Because everybody is ill, and everybody is afraid of death, and everybody is in trouble, and this man is the right person. Even if you die, he will revive you again. If you are ill, he will heal you. If you are poor, his stones can become notes. Anything is possible with this man. The whole Jewish race would have followed this man, but they didn't follow, and he was crucified. What is the reason? The reason is that miracles did happen, but they were not visible things. Only those who were near, they could feel those miracles. They did happen. Lazarus was dead, just as you are dead. If I make you alive, that will be something between me and you. Nobody else will be aware about it. Newspapers won't report it. It will not be announced from the radio and the TV. Nobody else will be aware of it. If I revive you in your inner world, this will be a matter between me and you. And you cannot prove it to anybody because it is invisible. That's why miracles happened, but Jesus' disciples could not prove it was such invisible phenomena. They looked within, but how can you prove it that you have looked? No photograph can be taken. Nobody else can be a witness to it. They started going around and telling people that we have seen miracles. Those who cannot see have seen. Those who were dead had become alive. And this created the trouble. And Jesus started asking, show us. And if this man is really the Son of God, and if he can do such miracles, then let us crucify him and see what happens. If he can revive others, he can resurrect himself. We will give him crucifixion and he will not die. If he knows the secret of immortality, if he is such a healer, then we will make wounds in his body and we'll see whether blood comes out of it or not. It is because of these disciples' foolishness that they started talking about miracles which are inner things. Jesus became a point for the whole country. He looked false. He is not a real, authentic Messiah. And then people were waiting that some miracle will happen. Nothing happened. He died just like other two criminals. Just like other two. Simply the same. An ordinary human being. Nothing of the God happened. No light descended from heaven. Neither the earth was shaken, nor there was an earthquake, nor God was angry and roaring in the skies, nothing. And the Son was crucified and God remained absolutely silent. That's why Jews have not regarded anything of Jesus. This man was a false man. Because he couldn't prove at the crucifixion. At the crucifixion was the test. There it was to be proved because he is a man of God or not. But those who could see this saw there also a great miracle. Christians have missed that. Jews missed the first miracle because they were waiting for something outside to happen. It never happened. They forgot this man. He was an imposter. Christians miss the inner thing that happened on crucifixion. Only few can see it. Those who have seen themselves can see it, what happened on the crucifixion. This man accepted. That was the miracle. This man suffered and accepted. This man suffered and still remained filled with love. That was the miracle. Those who were killing him, murdering him, he could pray even for them. That is the miracle. Greatest miracle ever happened on earth. The last words of Jesus were, "God, forgive them, because they don't know what they are doing. Don't punish them, because they are ignorant." This is the greatest miracle on crucifixion, when the whole body is suffering. You are dying, still filled with love. Anger would have been absolutely okay. If he had cried and cursed and said, "God, look what they are doing with your son. Kill them all." That would have been ordinary, human. This is divine. At crucifixion he proved that he is the Son of God, because compassion remained pure. You could not poison his compassion. You could not destroy his prayer. You could not destroy his heart. Whatsoever you did, he accepted you. He will not reject you. Even in that moment of suffering and misery, he will not reject you. He said, "Forgive them, because they don't know what they are doing." Miracles did happen, but they are not the miracles which the eyes can see. Only the heart can feel. He was not a magician. If he was a magician and really he tried to turn a stone into bread and tried to heal lepers into whole bodies, he is not worth much. I will not bother about him at all. The whole thing is useless then. But try to understand, as there is an inner blindness, there is an inner leprosy. You are so ugly. You have done this ugliness to yourself. So guilt-ridden, fear-filled, jealous, anxiety. This is the leprosy. It is eating your inner world like a worm. You are a wound inside. He healed. But that's a private thing. It happens between a master and the disciple. Nobody else becomes aware of it. Even the disciple becomes aware later on only. In the beginning, the master becomes aware that the wound is healed. It takes time for the disciple to become aware that the wound is healed. Ordinarily, for many, many days, he continues in the old idea that the wound is there. But nobody else can see it. Jesus says, "I am all. You are also all." Jesus is simply saying that which should be known to everybody, which should be felt by everybody. You are all. You are the source of all. And all is moving towards you. Jesus is just a representative of you. He is not saying anything about himself. He is saying something about you. You are the mustard seed. He has become the blooming tree. He is asserting about you. He's saying, I am all. What he means, he says, you can also become all. You are already all, but you are not aware about it. Your misery is that you cannot remember who you are. A self-remembering is needed. Nothing else is to be done. You have to become more conscious, more conscious. You have to raise your consciousness to a peak from where you can look. At that moment you become illuminated. No corner remains dark. Whole being becomes a flame. Then you will understand Jesus. Then you will understand Buddha. Then you will understand Krishna. Or then you will understand me. Because the whole effort is to make you aware of who you are. Remember these words. Let them vibrate into your heart again and again. Because through these words, your seed will have a shaking. Jesus said, I am the light that is above them all. I am the all, and the all came from me, and the all attained to me. Cleave a piece of wood, I am there. Lift up the stone, and you will find me there. Enough for today.